very brief public hearing on Senate Bill 346, just informationally more than anything. Basically, after discussion with several people involved in the PERS discussions going on in the building, Senator Menace and I are going to hold off for a short period of time and have some discussions with the employers and the unions to discuss whether or not expediting this or expediting these other potential appeals to the Supreme Court is where we want to go. I know that apparently Representative Williams has raised the issue in his Judiciary Committee that he has some concerns about that kind of behavior on the part of the legislature. So instead of moving forward and then trying to correct it, I think what we'll do is put this one on the shelf for a while and see where the players are on this, and if it makes sense, we'll come back with this at a later time. So, how's that for a short hearing? We still don't have a quorum, so I open the... I'm sorry, go ahead.
We have to introduce this measure at some point.
Okay, well, let's wait until the... oh, this is... do we need a quorum to do a bill introduction?
Yes.
Okay.
But you can open as a subcommittee for the purpose of public testimony.
Okay. I don't believe we have anybody on this. So I think what I'll do is open the public hearing on Senate Bill 365 then, if you're okay with that, Senator
Mercer. Sure. Of course.
Open public hearing on Senate Bill 365. Do we have anybody here to testify?
Yes.
Okay. Okay.
Mr. Chair, I'll begin while Gary's getting seated. For the record, I'm Brian DeLashman. I'm representing the Association of Work and Corrections Employees. With me is Gary Harkins today. Relatively simple bill, but let me just point out a couple of things. I know you're, at least the two members of this committee are well aware of, is the difference between the ability to strike and the strike bar provision in state statute. Strike bar being applied to a selective number of state employees and local employees because of the sensitive nature of their employment and the impact on public safety. This bill just adds all employees of a correctional facility or correctional institute rather than just the correctional officers. The language in line 7 is causing some people confusion, and I will just make mention of that. The old term guard is no longer applicable. It's now corrections employee or corrections officer. But the fact that there's a bracket around or guard at being deleted and then added back in at the end of that sentence, guard at mental hospital, does not change the status of anybody at a mental hospital and the type of employee that's being added. It's just, it used to read firefighter or guard at a correctional institute or mental hospital. And so it just clarifies moving the guard at to the mental hospital. So this bill, in fact, just includes the strike bar provision, which then goes to a binding arbitration process for employees of a correctional institution. With that, I'll give it to Gary.
Well, before we go to that, Brian, so just to be straight, so are there guards at the mental hospital now?
Whether they still call them guards or not, I would assume they're called guards. I don't think they're called anything else. Correctional, you know, they're not a correctional officer or whatever.
Life counselor.
Yeah,
have an OIA.
It may be, but this was specific to guards. It was not other employees of OIA.
Okay.
So it wouldn't. But the term guard in the correctional setting is passe. They don't call them guards anymore. They call them correctional officers. So that's why the term guard, even as it applies to a correctional institution, is no longer valid.
So. Thank you. Well, where's the rest of our committee?
They are not here. Okay, so Mr. Harkins?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Gary Harkins, and I'm a relief sergeant at the Oregon State Penitentiary, and I've been with the DOC for 23 years now. I'm also president of the Association of Oregon Corrections Employees. Today, all of the COs are currently strike barred. However, the non-correctional officer series or Security Plus or correction specialists, whichever you want to call them, That group includes RNs, dental assistants, food service coordinators, production coordinators, maintenance workers, including plumbers and electricians, just to name a few, are currently strike permitted. Due to a long and complex ERB and legislative history, which involves three unions and associations, essentially the DSC employees in this strike-permitted group, or this non-CO group, are currently three-fourths being strike-permitted and one-fourth of that group being strike-barred. Currently, two-thirds of the association's correction specialists are strike-barred, and our OCE industries folks are strike-permitted. In my tenure, there's been at least one strike and one or two potential strikes of these correction specialists, Security Plus, or non-COs. We believe that having these employees being permitted to strike can raise the risk to the public safety, staff safety, and put us in violation of the Oregon Constitution in regards to our Measure 17 responsibilities. In the last threatened strike, even though most of our association-represented institutions were not involved, our inmates' anxiety level rose to a point where we had to take extraordinary efforts to calm them down. We were looking at a drain of our institution's resources and a modification to our operations to fill in at those institutions that would have been targeted. This also made our staff's anxiety level rise. A telling example of what a strike could do to the DOC occurred on a smaller scale in 1996. The Oregon State Penitentiary in December of 96 was locked down as a result of a murder which occurred in our furniture factory. Our need of inmate labor to operate the institution became very apparent after they were locked in their cells. The DOC brought in managers and other volunteer staff from other institutions to help out. For some, it was the first time they'd ever been inside an institution. Our mental health, intake and release counselors, and clerical staff at the penitentiary were assigned to make approximately 8,000 sandwiches for the 4,000 sack lunches we delivered to the cells each day. With the inmates locked in their cells, that couldn't work. So we had to bring in extra staff so the OCE could fulfill their outside contracts, as well as provide the inmates with clean towels, clothes, and linens. Extra maintenance was brought in to handle the plugged toilets and other problems, as well as electrical issues. The overtime budget went through the roof because staff were placed on 10- and 12-hour schedules. Extra medical staff were brought in because we then had to deliver most of the medical services, such as issuing medications, at the cell instead of in the infirmary. We believe that a strike would have a similar effect. There are not enough managers, even at today's ratio of 8-to-1, to fill in. Our strike-barred staff would be pulled for other institutions, leaving us shorter than we currently are. Operations such as medical and food service would be greatly curtailed, and we would be under at least a modified lockdown, if not a full one. Staff overtime would again rise to fill in the gaps. Our constitutional mandate under Measure 17 to fully employ inmates would not be met. It's quite possible that OCE would also default on their external contracts and permanently lose vital income and damage their ability to attract new contracts. Bringing in contract staff from the community to fill gaps would raise serious safety and security issues, as well as increase the threat to the public safety. Because of the potential disruption and the safety and security concerns that a strike would bring, we believe that binding arbitration for all correctional employees, not just some, is the preferred way to go in collective bargaining. Under binding arbitration, the daily operations of an institution are not disrupted, staff and inmates' anxiety levels are not unduly raised, binding arbitration is less costly when compared to the cost of a strike and potential loss of industry's contracts. We all know that in a strike, no one really wins. We're all hurt by it, including the innocent bystanders. These non-CO Security Plus correction specialists provide critical, essential functions, including security, to an institution. They are a very important part of the public safety community, such as the corrections officers are, and such they should not be allowed to strike. They should be prohibited from striking. Please give them the right to binding arbitration the same right as corrections officers. Thank you, and I'll answer any questions if you have any.
Thank you very much. Any questions? Senator Menes?
Well, Department of Corrections, they're not here.
Mr. Chair, Senator Menes, I don't think they are.
I spoke to the Department of Corrections earlier today, and they said that because they understood this is only a public hearing today, that they would wait and weigh in if they needed to later on.
Oh, thank you for that.
Yes. Anything else? Thank you very much, folks.
Thank you.
Botkin, do you have a rejoinder? I want to note that Ms. Botkin is wearing OPEU purple today. I really appreciate that. It's a lobby day for OPEU, and we appreciate adjunct members.
You know, and showing brotherhood and sisterhood, you know, in the days of love and roses, you know, I always want to be like my brothers and sisters.
That's red and roses.
Oh, no, whatever.
I thought it was guns and roses.
That's what it's going to be next week
after
furs.
Mr. Chair, Senator Walker, that's what it used to be. Mr. Chair, for the record, my name is Mary Botkin. I'm here today representing the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees. We've not taken an official position on this bill, but let me just tell you our concerns. We have 1,000 non-security members spread out between 8 or 9 institutions around the state. I know that our membership is fairly well divided on this issue. Unfortunately, we did have a strike, or fortunately, whatever, however you want to look at it, with our non-security unit. It was a successful strike. There were no incidences in the institutions, and we felt that it was a good experience for our members, as good as any strike can be. And quite frankly, ERB has not been ruling to mix units. These are primarily our members, and it was our arbitration that decided how this was going to function. You know, we just don't know. We don't know why. I guess we don't know why the bill's in front of you, because Mr. Harkin's members are non-strikeable. They're all in his unit. They're all his members. And our members are spread out around the rest of the state. They're non-strikable. They're spread out amongst all the institutions. We have a lot of folks who don't want to go back into a security unit. They want to. They have very different issues and very different kinds of professional needs from our security staff. And where there are overlaps or similarities, we try to address that both at the bargaining table for those individuals specifically, and we also try to deal with that through training programs. And we have been successful in getting some pay increases for our people who assume security duties as part of our last settlement. So, you know, we're a little confused about why this bill is here, and if you want to do something with the bill, then I would suggest you do it to just affect his unit and leave our units alone.
Thank you. Any questions? Hearing none, I think we'll close this. Anybody else to testify? I guess I should ask.
No. Oh, and I was going to say, I'm sorry, I was going to say this, the state hospital, we have the doctors and nurses, and OPEU has the non-degreed staff. I don't know how this affects them at all. You know, we don't have a guard unit anymore. The guard unit, quote, guard unit, went away when Fairview closed. It was the last kind of guard unit in mental health that we had that I'm aware of. If it's forensics, then it would certainly be OPEU that would be affected by that, not us.
Well, Ms. Botkin, you anticipated my next comment, which was going to be, I'd like to see the three units involved, the three unions involved, have a discussion and before we take this any further. Thank you.
That's
we'll
fine.
Close
Thank
the works or the public hearing on Senate Bill 365. And Now that we have a quorum here, committee, we've been requested by the Republican leadership to introduce the Senate Interim Task Force on State-Owned Vehicle Efficiency Group, a LC draft on their behalf, 1321. Have these been passed out to the members? Basically, it modifies control and regulation of state-owned standard passenger vehicles and light-duty vehicles, something that's right up the accountability alley of the Republicans in this building. So I assume that you would all be much overjoyed to sponsor this.
You all, including yourself, Congressman Chair?
I wouldn't be so overamped about this if I wasn't so excited to be doing the work of the Republican Party. That's my job.
Oh, I guess. Anything I can do to get your blood pressure up.
Okay, good. So consider it done. We're going to, do we have to do, we're going to open a work session on possible measure introduction. One of the good senators, do I have a suggestion?
Yeah, what's the bill, the LC number? Mr. Chair, I would move that we introduce LC number 1321 as a committee bill.
Thank you so much, Senator Starr. Senator Starr recommends that we introduce this LC 1321 as a committee bill. Any discussion, any objection? Hearing none, thank you, but so done. All right. Now, on to the really juicy stuff panel. We're going to revisit. We're going to do a work session on House Bill 2170, one of the more stellar bills of the session. Please bring up the folks from that wonderful Housing and Community Relations radical outfit and speak, please.
Thank you.
And tell me why I was so wrong the first time and why I'm so right to pass this time.
I thought they took you out to the woodshed, Mr. Chair.
They didn't take me to the woodshed. They didn't take me to lunch. They didn't take me anywhere, Senator. Bob Repine just came in and basically convinced me of the errors of my way.
All right.
Senator Corcoran, members of the committee, I have nothing much further to add from my previous testimony, and I appreciate the chair's allowing us to revisit this legislation. As was discussed in the last hearing, we will be working with the Landlord-Tenant Coalition on a more comprehensive addressing of the landlord-tenant issues, of the manufactured park issues that were discussed by this committee. And I think, with that in mind, I think the chair was gracious to allow this work session today.
Thank you. So, yes, Senator Menace.
Sure, Mr. Kinney, would you explain to the committee how it is that the chair was wrong?
Thank you. I would be delighted to hear that.
The chair can do that himself if you'd like.
The chair was not wrong.
I was convinced by Mr. Repine that these folks don't have the authority of a true ombudsman.
Mr. Chair.
And that it caused confusion. Yes.
I would, if you're so inclined, I'd make a motion on the bill.
I am so glad to hear this so that my wrongness doesn't just dangle out there.
I would move House Bill 2170 to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Starr has moved House Bill 2170 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Heather, would you call the roll, please?
Senator Starr?
Aye.
Senator Walker?
Aye.
Vice Chair Minnis?
Aye.
Jeff Walker?
Aye.
Thank you.
Okay, since I was
hurry off before
the one that caused
mind.
Another thing, I will carry it. We will close the work session on House Bill 2170, and we will open another extremely controversial bill from these very same people, House Bill 2169. And the testimony is coming up as we speak. Who is our... Who do we have here? Well, my gosh, Jack Kenny, what a surprise. Come up, Mr. Kenny. Take your medicine like a man. Oh, yes, excuse me. Please, staff, would you read what the measure does?
Chair Corcoran, members of the committee, House Bill 2169 authorizes the Housing and Community Services Department to use the Guarantee Fund Housing Development and Guarantee account to guarantee loans on commercial components of structures containing both commercial property and low-income housing, allows for a preference for certain properties in the granting of loan guarantees.
Thank you very much, Mr. Kenny.
Thank you, Chair Corcoran, members of the committee. I'm Jack Kenny, Deputy Director, Oregon Housing and Community Services Department. As was just noted, this bill allows us to use our Housing Development Guarantee Account guarantee program to guarantee loans on projects that include both the commercial and residential aspect or component. The program guarantees up to 25% of the original principal amount of a loan. Preference is given to loans that offer long-term affordability and serve special needs populations such as the frail and elderly. Although projects may contain both commercial and residential elements, when using the Oregon Housing Fund as the source of the guarantee, the current law restricts Oregon Housing and Community Service to provide loan guarantees only on the housing portion of the projects. This has come into the reason that we're introducing this bill is that we, as we are getting more involved with downtown revitalization projects and we see smaller communities that want to have housing in their downtowns, it's typical to have a commercial section on the ground floor. Typically, tenants don't want to live on the ground floor because there's so much foot traffic in a downtown area. So it's more financially viable to have commercial portion on the ground floor level. However, these structures typically have components that are shared by both the housing and the residential components of the building. One that comes to mind is the Commodore in the Dalles that we worked on, the Commodore Hotel in the Dalles. It has office space on the fourth floor, it has commercial space on the ground floor, and housing in the second and third floors. So they share common elevators, stairways, things like that, certain common areas. Therefore, it's difficult, if not impossible, to condominiumize a structure like that. If it's a new development, such as we had in Pendleton, we're able to design around that and be able to do that. But with an existing structure that's being rehabbed, which a lot of these downtown projects are, you can't do that. A lot of the people that come in and bring tax credits, for example, to the program, they're familiar with housing, but they're not as comfortable with residential. If, particularly in the early years of the redevelopment, if you don't have a guarantee, you won't get as good of a price for the tax credits, or perhaps the tax credit investors won't even be interested in coming into the program. We believe this will be a valuable tool in achieving the objectives of bringing affordable housing to downtown areas throughout the state. I think I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Condo minimize. So I learned a new word today. Yes, Senator.
Jack, remind me, where does the principal for this fund come from?
Chair Corcoran, Senator Minnis, the principal is the housing fund that's described in ORS 458-600. It's currently $15.5 million.
But where does the money come from?
It was an appropriation in 1991, is my understanding. I believe it came at the time that the
the $5 million appropriation in 1991, if I recall correctly.
I believe there were two, yes. I believe that was part of it, and there was an appropriation in one other year that brought the total to $15.5 million.
Okay, correct. I think that was 93, if I'm not mistaken, when I chaired Ways and Means. Is there another question?
Sir, miss.
The language on line 5, help me understand it. Is this just a restructuring in the first three sentences? The Housing and Community Service Department shall hold, and it's the language shall hold and use the principal. It looks to me like it's replacing the language on line 7 where it says shall be held. Is that just a technical?
Chair Corcoran, Senator Minnis, that's correct.
So then on line 8, it says the department shall use the fund, and then it deletes shall be used, but it includes the word only to guarantee. Why is the word only presented there?
Chair Corcoran, Senator Minnis, that is the only purpose of the corpus of the fund. The earnings on the fund are described in another section of the statute to be used for low-income housing grants, but there is no other use for the corpus of the fund currently.
Okay, but that existed prior to this inclusion of the word only, is that not correct?
Chair Corcoran, Senator Minnis, that is correct.
So any idea why it's being pursued in this bill? You're basically restating what already exists.
That is my understanding. I believe Legislative Council was cleaning up some older language when the concept was brought forward.
So your department didn't request the word only, is that correct?
Chair Corcoran, Senator Minnis, that is correct.
All right, and then, Mr. Chairman, again, on line 11, where it says the department by rule shall specify the grounds on which it may deny loan guarantees for a structure that contains both commercial and low-income housing components. Give me a sense for what kind of grounds you'd be talking about, where you're going to go with that. I get real uneasy with just general rulemaking authority without some specific statutory direction.
I understand, Senator Corcoran, Chair Minnis. The grounds would... I think the two primary grounds that were discussed internally at the department were, one, if we believe that it was not a prudent investment, the corpus of the trust fund is a very valuable asset to the department in providing affordable housing grants. And we wanted to keep the use of this program very limited. And we were trying to make that clear both in the statute, and we'll make it even more clear in the rules, that this is not something that will be used frequently. We only have 4 loans currently outstanding that are guaranteed, and those, you know, with housing only components. So one of the grounds would be that the commercial component and the commercial, I guess the underwriting of the commercial element would have to be fairly secure. And the second aspect would be that the commercial component would have to be limited in scope. It's clearly what we're about is affordable housing. This bill is to prevent us from providing affordable housing when there's a roadblock in our way, as I described with the Commodore, where you have kind of an intertwined commercial and housing element. So we want the commercial element to be certainly not the major component of the loan.
So are you telling me this is, in essence, a due diligence clause? You want to make sure that you're doing your due diligence and ensure the fiduciary responsibility that your agency has over the corpus of the fund?
That's correct.
Okay. Now, Mr. Chairman, again, on line 12, page 2, again, the council may adopt a policy that gives loan guarantee preference. Tell me about that language and why that's there and what that's envisioned to do.
Chair Corcoran, Senator Minnis, all other things being equal, as I described earlier, the one important element of affordable housing, probably the largest piece, is the federal low-income housing tax credit. And we believe that this particular loan guarantee program provides more value than just when it can be used to coax, if you will, to make the value to the tax credit investor that they'll pay a higher price for the tax credits, if you will. The federal tax credit program provides a significant amount of risk to a tax credit investor if the program should, in a sense, be unable to make their loan payments, and they lose the affordable housing component. Then a person who invested in a federal tax credit is expecting a 10-year return on that investment, is expecting a 10-year tax credit. If the commercial portion of the loan would fail and therefore cause the entire loan to go into default, that tax credit investor is at a significant risk. So what the line 12 on page 2 is designed to do is to give the housing council discretion where, all other things equal, they're able to say, because this not only provides affordable housing but allows the tax credit investor to come in at a more reasonable price so that the developer can keep their costs down and therefore keep it affordable for low-income Oregonians, that would be another instance whereby a factor, if you will, in granting the loan guarantee.
Okay. All right.
Okay, thank you. Any other questions, colleagues? Hearing none, let's close the public hearing, open a work session on House Bill 2169, which I must add, because of Mr. Kenney's silver-tongued eloquence, passed the House 58 to nothing. So, do I hear a motion?
Okay. Mr. Chairman, Senator Minnis, House Bill 2169 at the floor of the Senate with a due pass recommendation, unamended.
Senator Minnis moves House Bill 2169, unamended, to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion?
Mr. Chairman.
Yes.
I just want to make it perfectly clear for the record that there were some attacks on this fund, I think, during one of the special sessions or more with respect to resources, and notwithstanding the amendments in this bill, it doesn't limit the legislature's ability to access these funds should it become necessary.
Okay, thank you very much. Any other comments? Ms. Gravel, will you call the roll, please?
Senator Sauer?
Aye.
Senator Walker?
Aye.
Aye.
Chair Corcoran?
Aye. So, is it the will of the committee to put both of these on the consent calendar? Or would you like to speak to this, Senator Minnis, on the 2169, put 2170 on the consent calendar?
I think let's put 2169 on the normal channel, if you will, because
okay.
There may be some questions.
So 2170 on the consent calendar, 2169 on the normal calendar, which means we'll hear it 3 days earlier. I love the consent
calendar. We'll give the concerned individuals a chance to kind of root out the issues to make sure they're happy.
think that's it, colleagues. Thank you very much. We're adjourned.
We got bills to file.
No, you realize I gave you a